This Marketplace Morning Report special is supported by McDermott Will & Emery, forward-thinking legal advisors helping clients successfully navigate the CARES Act and other emerging legislation. More at mwe.com/cares.
Welcome to The Economy Reimagined, a Marketplace special report. In 2015, researchers working with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston set out to measure the wealth of households. How's your savings? Do you own a house, a car, maybe some appraised jewelry? Subtract what people owe, and that's called net worth. For the typical Boston area white household, it's $247,500, about $250,000. The median net worth of black households in the region, $8, eight, no zeros missing. This is about race and many other structural factors. I'm David Brancaccio, host of our Morning Report.
And I'm Marketplace's Kimberly Adams. Earlier this year, we commissioned a Marketplace Edison research poll to measure economic insecurity. As you might expect, given the pandemic, the economic anxiety index rose by the most we'd ever seen. But here's the thing. For people earning $25,000 a year or less, at that point, their financial anxiety hadn't gone up. It was flat compared to last year. Experts see this as evidence low-income people were already living with pandemic levels of economic insecurity well before the first case of COVID-19 showed up in the U.S. And folks earning $25,000 or less every year, that's a fifth of Americans.
It's also suffocating debt. No extra cash if car or body hits a bump. The costs of healthcare, childcare, education, and just who has access to the training and the connections to turn your good idea into a business. It's clear the system that provides our livelihoods, the economy, could do better for us and for the earth. That's what this program is all about.
Ideas to go beyond economic recovery and towards a system that works better for more people. This moment, the combination of the pandemic and the renewed energy of the social justice movement is prompting many to say now is the time to consider new ideas, policies and strategies that may have seemed unthinkable in the before times. We're going to explore some of these ideas with the help of a couple of families. We'll start with Francis Cox and Jason Perez. They're divorced and co-parenting their 17-year-old daughter, Nisa, in Chicago. Francis is 46.
I grew up on the west side of Chicago, the oldest of three children to a single mother. And I wasn't really sure about finances and like taking care of myself and those kinds of things as a young person.
Jason is 39 and was raised in a middle-class family on the north side of the city. His dad was a police officer and his mom was a hospital claims manager.
You know, my parents owned their house. And, you know, so I think there's always these moments where you think, oh, I should really be owning a house at this moment. Oh, I should really be doing this.
Growing up, Jason and Francis expected to follow a path that tracked the American dream. But life for so many families is much more complicated than that. Francis did well in school and after a $100,000 four-year education, now has a business cleaning houses.
Every day, I wonder to myself, do I dislike this job because I feel like it's demeaning? And that in itself is problematic to me. My grandmother cleaned toilets. There's nothing wrong with cleaning. And then I say to myself, you know, is it because I'm doing this manual labor? You know, is it because it's hard work?
Jason dropped out of school at 15 and fell into addiction, which led to prison. But he got out, got sober, and is now a researcher with a social justice advocacy organization. The Perez Cox family is among many who have experienced what happens when the economy doesn't quite work out, and they're helping us reimagine systems that could bring financial security to more people.
Kimberly, let's start our reimagining by turning to Andre M. Perry at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings, who works on ways to confront structural racism. Where would he start?
Wow, there's so many things from reparations to business ownership and business financing.
But if he had to start with one.
I'll go with if we can increase the number of black businesses that have more than one employee by 15%, we can expand the economy by $55 billion.
Frances Cox runs a one-person business. She's an independent contractor. And despite her reservations about the work, she likes the flexibility of cleaning houses.
I'm able to be home to help my daughter with her homework. I get to control my schedule. It's like I have my own business.
But if she ever wanted to expand that business, take on employees, for example, there are obstacles baked into the process.
Yeah, 4 years ago, the Center for Global Policy Solutions calculated that because of discrimination in lending, more than 1 million businesses that could have been never happened, nor did 9 million jobs or $300 billion in income. A Federal Reserve study, controlling for credit score, found that banks give a harder time to minority-owned businesses seeking loans. This year, amid the renewed energy of the social justice movement, some brand-name firms are stepping up to offer some of those loans themselves. Pepsi has pledged to lend $50 million over 5 years to black-owned businesses, responding to calls to, quote, hire or wire. Now, investment is the wire part. Here's Perry with the other one.
I'm from Pittsburgh, where Google landed its headquarters there. The black communities around that neighborhood are struggling. There has to be a deliberate effort to invest in black lives whenever a company comes to town. Remember, many of these companies could change the economic trajectories of communities with a snap of a finger by hiring them.
Perry is author of the book Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities.
There's another family helping us with this project, Rochelle Rittmaster and her brother Roland. He's 56, living in Houston, and struggling economically.
I mean, I don't know if I could ever make a decent living. So if I want to stay poverty level, I stay in my career. I've worked really hard in the field, and it's led me to a position to where I only see poverty.
That career is working as a massage therapist, which barely paid the bills even before the pandemic, when you could still touch people. Now the work has dried up, so one of his siblings, his sister Rochelle, is helping him out. She lives in Denver and is sending him $500 a month. Rochelle's had a successful career as an engineer, but she's quick to acknowledge that her own economic life could have played out very differently.
You just have to have luck, it seems. I can't say what that predictive path could be.
Even though she and Roland grew up in the same family in the same city, Kansas City, Missouri, they're about a decade apart in age. And Roland had a much tougher home life. Their father died when he was still really young, and their mother struggled with mental health issues.
It seems like a person's trajectory can turn on just about anything. Whether it is an accident or illness, whether it is a particular choice of path.
Or things individuals can't control, your race or ethnicity, or particular systems or policies baked into law.
An economy that doesn't treat people right can fuel anger. Political economist Mark Blythe at Brown University's Watson Institute distinguishes between corrosive anger that pits factions against each other versus the fuel for positive change.
A kind of righteous anger, a kind of moral anger that is a desire to be heard. And it's something you see in a lot of the populist uprisings of both left and right, this notion that we're not being listened to our elites and that they play by a different set of rules.
Blythe co-authored a new book with a hedge fund guy called Angrynomics that has a lot of reimagining in it. For instance, maybe big digital companies would pay people when they turn our data into gold. And Blythe is shopping the notion of the U.S. pulling a kind of Norway by creating a massive public endowment. Now, Norway's got North Sea oil profits for its sovereign wealth fund. What the U.S. has is super low interest rates that make government borrowing super cheap. He's among those who think rates will stay low from now on because inflation isn't just dead. Blythe thinks it's
dead.
Since borrowing at 0% is practically free, he suggests the government could go and buy tons of stocks, bonds, and other investments and let them grow on the markets. Call it a citizens' wealth fund, maybe like Harvard's huge endowment, but mega.
The The public owns the wealth, not in the way of some socialist notion, in a very capitalist notion that we are passive investors in the national fund for our wealth, and then basically we're able to distribute the earnings from that, not to the top, but more to the middle and the bottom.
Maybe a person could cash out of this to start a business when they turn 21 or help pay for college or something. Now, there are risks. A new world war would blow up the fund, but in that case, we'd have bigger problems, Blythe says. And some people, especially a subset of conservatives, worry inflation is not dead and buried, but could roar back, making the cost of servicing all the government debt a new burden on future generations. Staying on this theme of financial innovation, let's talk about what is called a social bond.
Investors are willing to raise funds, put money on the table for projects with a positive social outcome. And the real opportunity to provide an investment return to the investor as well.
Patrice Kunesh is the former director of the Center for Indian Country Development at the Minneapolis Fed and is now at the Native American Rights Fund.
Tribal governments do have the capacity to issue bonds, but I'd love to see a private-public partnerships where we could combine purpose with profit. And I think Indian country is a very attractive opportunity for investors, especially the opportunity to use lands for agriculture purposes, for energy development.
Kunesh, who's of Standing Rock Lakota descent, says tribal governments have to get the authority to determine how the outside investment would be used. But clean water, proper housing, and fast internet are places to start. Social bonds are in the news, with some big philanthropies borrowing to increase the grants those charities can give out during the pandemic. Those social bonds sold well. Another place where the horrors of COVID have inspired new thinking has to do with the $1,200 pandemic checks. Those look, taste, and smell very much like an anti-poverty system that's been under study for years, the universal basic income. This is where governments hand out money routinely, even when there's no emergency. Because for many, the emergency never ends, and further disruption is set to come when software and machines do more of our jobs.
And I'm afraid that, you know, through this pandemic, through this crisis, we just kind of sped up to our future.
Jose Quiñones founded Mission Asset Fund, which has devised a variety of innovations in the name of financial inclusion. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient.
I believe that there's dignity and purpose in work, and I believe that to my core. But I also think that there's dignity in helping each other out, and particularly when, you know, people are not able to work for no fault of their own.
Beyond COVID, Quiñones is among the many, including Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who support a universal basic income to create a financial floor for people amid rapid technological change.
This Marketplace Morning Report special is supported by McDermott Will & Emery, an international law firm helping clients understand options and seize opportunities as they navigate today's complex business restructuring landscape. More at mwe.com/restructuring.
It's The Economy Reimagined, a Marketplace special report. I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Kimberly Adams. There are systems and policies in place that widen inequality. This comes into sharper focus when you watch what can happen within a family. Take Jason Perez, whom we met earlier. He dropped out of high school, got mixed up with drugs, and ended up in prison. When he got out at 19, he wanted to make a fresh start.
I was living in a halfway house. I was on parole. You know, I was getting rejected job after job. And at that point, I was kind of like, man, I should go back to selling drugs, even though I was a terrible drug dealer at that point, hence getting caught and, you know, and being locked up. But I was just like, you know, I needed real money and a real job.
This was 20 years ago, and Jason says he ran into employer after employer who shunned people with criminal records, something that's now illegal in Illinois. A pivot point for him was when he finally landed a steady job at the American Civil Liberties Union. It was a living wage, he maintained sobriety, and got back to his education. Now he works at a nonprofit called the Action Center for Race and the Economy in Chicago.
Most of the friends that I have that I know from back then, you know, the breaking point was whether they got a meaningful job. Not a job that barely pays you a living wage and you can't get by, but people who had access to meaningful employment that paid them a fair wage, they usually ended up doing way better than a lot of my homies.
As we reimagine ways to create more meaningful jobs, there's one approach that's right in front of us, tantalizing like a set of crown jewels in a locked viewing case.
Infrastructure.
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 You know what that is. Liberals and conservatives tend to be all for it. I'm just going to call it the big I. It's one of the first things that comes to mind for a daughter of a coal miner who shapes policy to reduce inequality in urban and rural communities in Ohio and Appalachia. Hannah Halbert is executive director of the nonprofit Policy Matters Ohio. She imagines a world where people stop talking and start building.
We can't just train for training's sake. And we have a multitude of problems that need to be solved. That if we can connect public investment to something like making our electric grid more efficient, more able to withstand the challenges of a changing climate, that investment not only would put us on a path for greater security, but would get people employed. And if those jobs are good jobs, if those jobs are union jobs, building apprenticeship programs around that investment, it can lift an entire region.
Big I infrastructure is about the outcome of building and fixing for society. Others focus on the outcome for the well-being of the people who get the work. It's an idea with roots in the New Deal during the Great Depression, proposing that the government should hire anyone who wants a job and can't find a good one in the private sector. Here's Pavlina Chernova, the author of a new book called The Case for a Job Guarantee.
So if we're rethinking the post-COVID world of work, I think it is important to ask, why should we tolerate 2%, 3%, 5%, whatever economists might call the natural rate of unemployment? And when you think about how we design other policies, we don't talk about 2%, 3%, 5% of illiteracy rate. And so it's the job guarantee does the same for the labor market.
Chernova is with the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. And I pointed out this would mean these government jobs would compete for workers, driving up the cost of labor for private employers.
Now, if the argument is that we should have permanent unemployment so that private firms should have the right to pay below living wages or maybe even poverty wages, then maybe that's the world we need to leave behind.
Same with the minimum wage debate. Private companies say if labor costs more, they'll hire fewer people. But in this system, the government is the backstop.
And in that world the professor wants to leave behind, even following the traditional path to get a job that pays a living wage doesn't work for many. Frances Cox from Chicago, we heard from earlier, says she did really well in school, even finished a four-year degree in anthropology, but found she couldn't do much with it unless she took on more debt to get an advanced degree.
And I love anthropology. And I thought to myself, you know, it really sucks that I live in a place where something as valuable as the study of culture is undervalued and not appreciated. And I feel hurt sometimes that I have to consider that a bad decision, a bad economic decision.
Jason, her ex-husband, told me that while education was considered important in his home growing up, it was only one ingredient of a decent livelihood.
I grew up in a family that just stressed, you know, working class, middle class values of work hard, but also try to work in an industry or do the type of work that values you and pays you a fair wage and a living wage. Usually that's related to some sort of union job or a job where you're protected as a worker.
You hear Jason say union job as part of that vision of the American dream. And it's been noted that inequality went up in the decades that the prevalence of union membership decreased, even controlling for globalization. Javier Morillo spent 14 years as president of a Minnesota local of the Service Employees International Union.
Today, what we're looking at is an economy that is increasingly made up of temporary laborers, temp agencies, that sort of work. Employers have figured out through those mechanisms ways of making it difficult to impossible for workers to organize, right? How do you organize a temp agency? And so the challenge facing the labor movement today and in the last decades has been to adjust to an economy that is no longer industrial.
He's now a fellow at the Center for Innovation in Worker Organization at Rutgers University. He's thinking about non-union workers who recently banded together during the pandemic to call attention to what they saw as health and safety problems at Amazon warehouses.
So I think that's the moment we are in, and many people are rising to the challenge. And the labor movement, I think, as a whole, has to sort of broaden its scope to be really a worker movement where traditional labor is just one part of what we do.
A key part of what is called this contingent workforce are gig economy jobs, often the ones where customers book labor using a mobile app. Juliet Shore at Boston College finds this gig world is increasingly a tough one.
People are having to work a lot more, spend a lot more time trying to get gigs, many more people looking for work than work is available. And the other very precarious dimension of this is that these workers have none of the protections that employees have.
There's a clash of titans over this, with Uber and others fighting a new California law classifying many gig workers not as contractors, but as employees entitled to benefits. Shore's forthcoming book is called After the Gig: How the Sharing Economy Got Hijacked and How to Win It Back. One approach she studied is the banding together of contract workers who can form their own company with its own rules. She studied photographers who license out their pictures. Think of this as a gig co-op.
There are things that some of these cooperatives do, either offering discounted healthcare or, if the cooperative can afford it, financing healthcare for its members.
It gets complicated, she says, because co-ops have to deal with whether to provide full benefits to casual members compared to those who contribute a lot. Another way to take on inequality is to consider the rules for entering an occupation. Back in the 1950s, just 5% of occupations required a license. Now it's 23%. It can take 3 years training to get an optician's license in Nevada, but no time at all in California. Johns Hopkins professor Stephen Tellis thinks licenses sometimes help with health, safety, and fraud, but can also unfairly favor existing players, hurt competition, and make inequality worse.
The consequence of that is, first of all, that we don't get lots of new models that might serve people better. We often have to pay more for those services, and we end up driving up the incomes of the people who are behind those regulatory schemes.
Tellis, along with a former Cato Institute guy, Brink Lindsay, wrote this in The Captured Economy: How the Powerful Enrich Themselves, Slow Down Growth, and Increase Inequality. Kimberly?
One example of that, David, is our friend Roland in Texas. He ran into licensing barriers. Roland wanted to be a physical therapist, which would have set him on a path for higher paying jobs, but...
I tried to get into physical therapy programs. They were too stringent and difficult to get into. So I came to Texas and got a license in massage and have been doing therapeutic body work ever since.
If there are unnecessary barriers to entry into an occupation, what is the proposed fix? There is a wild amount of money in lobbying by existing players to keep the rules as they are. Tellis reimagines a world where members of Congress and state legislators get a much bigger subsidy to hire more experienced staff that can arm themselves with the data to stop industry from bulldozing efforts to unwind self-serving rules. As of last year, everybody in the U.S. together owed $1.7 trillion on their student loans. That's huge, like 8% of the entire U.S. economy. Can Europe's experience funding higher education inform our reimagining? Here's my Marketplace colleague, the BBC's Victoria Craig in London.
No matter what country you're from, walking across the stage at graduation is a big moment.
Abigail Butler.
For 23-year-old Abigail Butler, it was a relief. She graduated from Bangor University in North Wales 2 years ago with a degree in psychology and $54,000 in debt.
It's quite scary, and I think maybe I will pay it back, but I very well might not.
That's because many students in the UK pay tuition and living expenses using government loans. They only start repaying them once they make more than $34,000 a year. Even then, only 9% of their earnings above that threshold go toward repayments. And if the debt is not paid off within 30 years, it's totally forgiven. According to the College Board, the average 2018 graduate in the United States took out $29,000 in loans to pay for their undergraduate studies. And data from the Federal Reserve show paying that back requires fixed mortgage-like monthly repayments. Professor Jill Wyness from the University College London says a move to the more progressive sliding scale British system could help American students.
The repayment burden is minimized. So you don't have a situation where a student graduates, doesn't have a job, and then has to start finding ways to repay their loan. That just doesn't happen here. They're protected from the risk. And I think that's an extremely important sort of safety net.
In the UK, the average yearly costs are around $11,000. Prior to 1998, college students here had been able to attend any public university for free, like in Germany and France. But Professor Nick Barr at the London School of Economics says free education in England didn't guarantee equal participation.
Of 100 students from a middle-class background, 85 went to university. And of 100 students from working-class backgrounds, 15 went to university. The problem in Germany and France, particularly France, is it's free and anyone can go. So you've got huge classes and a high dropout rate.
He says the free system works further north in
Sweden, Norway, Finland. Those are countries where people are prepared to pay high taxes in return for high quality public services. Those countries have very good nursery education, and therefore the class gradient in participation in higher education is much less pronounced than it is in most European countries or the US.
In Norway, public spending on higher education clocks in at around 1.7% of economic output. In the US, it's less than 1%. Back in the UK, Abigail Butler has just started repaying her loans at a cost of around $50 a month.
It doesn't worry me because the debt is not the same as, you know, if I had £42,000 out on a credit card.
Higher education reform is one lever to pull when thinking about how to rebuild a battered U.S. economy. But what blueprint policymakers use could come down to this choice: higher public spending for a fully funded system like the Scandies, or one like the British have, which splits the burden more evenly between higher income earners and the government. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
Let's talk to the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, a Democrat, who says she won't let a pandemic stop her plan to end poverty in her city. It's about access to credit to help people build wealth. It's about linking more people who've done prison time to jobs and a minimum wage that will go up to $15 an hour by next year. Plus, fixing health care with wide disparities in infant mortality depending on neighborhood. Mayor Lightfoot, welcome.
It's my pleasure, David.
It didn't take protests that followed the police killing of George Floyd to get you focused on economic inequality there.
No, the absence of, which is how we think of poverty, really has a number of cascading problems that flow from that. At the end of February, we launched our first ever poverty summit and outlined steps to end poverty in a generation. But the COVID crisis, I think, has really brought those measures into stark relief. When we think about the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 has had on Black and brown communities, stemming a lot from the unequal access to healthcare, we know that we need to accelerate the things that we had planned step by step and really build them up much more expeditiously.
And it's lots of things your team is thinking about. I mean, just one of them is a very practical thing. The cost, often the high cost, of just connecting your address to gas, water, and power.
We saw prior to my the start of my administration, people really literally being disconnected from water services. I regard water as a basic human right. So we stopped that even before I officially took office. And we started a process now to bring people back into connection and give them the opportunity after a year of making payments to get rid of any pre-existing debt.
But on the fines and fees and the licenses, I mean, the city of Chicago helps run itself with the money you get from those. The idea is to rethink that?
We have to rethink it, and here's why. Yes, the city has historically relied heavily, but we also have literally debt going back to the 1990s that we're absolutely never going to be able to collect. But the larger problem is when you put people in a position where they're literally driven into bankruptcy, where they can't get access to basic city services, you're taking those people out of the economy. We need people contributing. We need people to feel like they've got a stake in their future here in Chicago, and not that the city is basically putting up a stop sign and saying, we don't want you, you don't belong here unless you pay up.
Lori Lightfoot is an attorney and the mayor of Chicago since 2019. Thank you very much for this.
It's my pleasure.
This Marketplace Morning Report special is supported by McDermott, Will & Emery, forward-thinking legal advisors helping clients successfully navigate the CARES Act and other emerging legislation. More at mwe.com/cares. Reimagining the Economy is supported by McDermott, Will, and Emery.
It's The Economy Reimagined, a Marketplace special report. I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Kimberly Adams.
With the tech economy generally still doing very well in this very tough year, what's to reimagine? Well, there is an argument for spreading it out. Here's how California Congressman Ro Khanna sees it.
I think we have to realize we're going through a technology revolution that has benefited certain parts of this country. It's actually right now what's driving a lot of the stock market and growth, but a lot of people have been left out, and we have not been intentional about getting people a pathway to these jobs of the future.
And the people who have been left out, like Roland in Houston, notice that disconnect.
People like me, I don't have any money to be putting in the stock market. I don't have the knowledge or the money. And so I don't really have a nest egg like a lot of the certain percent of the population at the top. So, yeah, I'm not sure. I don't ever see myself retiring, put it that way. But I work until I die.
When I asked him about his future prospects, he emphasized his age. He's 56.
It's hard to accept that I'm at a point in my life where my financial future is in question. So my sister, without her help, not sure what would have happened. I might have gotten very depressed and just gave up. Not sure. But I don't have an industry that I feel like I can make a living anymore. I have skills, but to attain another certificate or another degree at my age is going to be very difficult.
So how might Roland get connected to a job of the future?
Well, that Congressman Ro Khanna, a Democrat representing California's Silicon Valley, does not want to hoard the tech jobs. He wants more technology work in more places. He's been working in West Virginia, Kentucky, and the South to do just that, putting fast data connections everywhere to help with business development and remote education would cost, Khanna says, about $80 billion.
I think the high-speed internet, that's just the table stakes. And then we need incentives and imaginative policies that are going to get people to take a chance in recruiting from places where tech companies haven't gone. I mean, there's a lot of talent out there, but some of the recruiting has been myopic. We've overlooked historically black colleges and universities, for example. So one example is Zoom just announced a partnership, which Representative Clyburn and I led with the Claflin University.
That's a historically black campus in South Carolina, linking with our ubiquitous new workmate, Zoom. It's a 5-year deal built in part around internships. Khanna points out China is spending like mad to get its tech jobs sprinkled outside the usual places, and it's just part of this trend. As the reimagining goes beyond the U.S. economy to matters of global financial inclusion, we note the capital of Kenya, Nairobi, is now a thriving tech hub.
They call it the Silicon Savannah. You see, African, especially sub-Saharan African countries, are well ahead of the rest of the world.
Mauro Guillen is a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Africa could be ripe for more Silicon Savannas beyond Nairobi, Johannesburg, South Africa, and Lagos, Nigeria.
When it comes to the adoption of mobile payments, for instance, and also telemedicine, we're only discovering it now in the United States because we are selectively under lockdown. But they've been practicing telemedicine for at least 10 years. So in some ways, actually, Africa is ahead of the curve relative to the rest of the world. They're innovating.
Guillen's new book is called 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Affect the Future of Everything.
It's also a huge opportunity because Africa will have by far the youngest population in the world. And economies tend to be more dynamic when the population is younger on average.
Speaking of youthful dynamism, Nisa Perez, the daughter of Francis Cox and Jason Perez in Chicago, she and I were talking about her view of the changing economy. She's already active in social justice causes, and at 17, she says it's clear to her the economy as it exists, even before COVID, doesn't work for her community.
To have everything that you need to survive, it shouldn't be a survival of the fittest game. You should have a house. You should be able to have water. You should be able to have lights. You should be able to have food. You should be able to have money.
What do we have? Three of the most transformational events of our lifetimes happening at the same time? Wait, it's four. A pandemic, an economic collapse, a national, if not global, re-engagement on race and inequality. And, oh yes, did we mention that with all the carbon dioxide we let out, the planet is heating up to the point that parts will no longer be livable? Here's a man who's come up with a plan to take all the bad carbon out of the U.S. economy within just 15 years. Not 50, 15. Not by making life more austere and miserable, but by electrifying everything.
It may sound audacious, but it shouldn't sound crazy.
MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Saul Griffith is an engineer and CEO of a research group called Other Lab. He's one of the authors of a report done with a nonprofit called Rewiring America. They did the math and found that if everything's run by electricity, we probably need about half the energy we thought. A total conversion in what must sound like a shockingly short time would be a wild undertaking in the way that the economy was ramped up for the Second World War.
If we are serious about what we should be doing for the planet in terms of our carbon dioxide targets, this is the level of effort required to do it. And in terms of COVID, this is a historic opportunity, like the Great Depression, like World War II, to do sort of the massive infrastructure spending required, and it will create the jobs we need, and ultimately we will have a stronger, more resilient, better prepared nation in the future with a healthier populace if we do it.
And while shifting people out of fossil fuel jobs will be tough to bear for many, Griffith says the traditional energy industry has become more automated and is not as labor-intensive as what would be needed for his big switchover. Griffith's report estimates the conversion to everything powered by wind, solar, and hydro would create 25 million jobs, with 5 million more jobs than we have now after electric everything is in place.
We don't pay for the wind or the sunshine, as you do in extracting the coal and natural gas. And all of the machines required for that require a little bit more labor because we have to install them and maintain them. It will create more jobs.
The group's total decarbonization plan is open to using some nuclear power for a transition period, with the risks that come with that, although Griffith doubts nuclear can compete on cost with other renewables. This crash program to decarbonize energy is one approach. Another way to address climate change that also claims more jobs is to make everything renewable, not just sources of energy. It's called the circular economy.
Once you realize that something is not waste, it's food for something else, then you design with waste equals food.
William McDonough is an architect and designer who co-wrote what is widely considered a watershed book in the history of the sustainability movement, Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things. You think of banana peels that become compost for plants and worms, but scale this globally. Instead of buying LED light bulbs, maybe you sign up for a lighting service that retrieves the bulbs when they're done and harvests all the components, including the rare earth elements inside. In Switzerland, McDonough helped the venerable office furniture company, Steelcase, do a fabric out of sustainable everything.
We did it out of wool and rayme. Rayme is a fiber. And then all the dyes and the mordants and the rinses are all so clean that the water coming out of the factory is as clean as Swiss drinking water, which is what it is. So you're not polluting. The trimmings used to be hazardous waste. They had to be shipped to Spain from Switzerland because you couldn't burn it or bury it in Switzerland. So it's a cost to the business. The trimmings of the cloth become mulch for the local garden club. And by the way, a lot of people have sat on that fabric. It's in the Airbus.
Airbus, the jetliners. He's also got a building at Oberlin College in Ohio that controls its waste and creates more energy than it consumes.
It's a building like a tree. A tree, you know, collects more energy from solar energy than it requires to live. It actually accrues and grows. Amazing. And it purifies water. So that's what we want to design, systems that are like that. They're regenerative.
He draws from the energy production part of this to make a larger point about the circular economy creating more work, even given the disruption it would produce for people whose jobs are rooted in the existing way of doing things.
There's so much to do in renewable power. There is so little to do in coal. So focus. This is job creation. This is for how do we meaningfully engage with the world today and have great work for people to do.
Perhaps some of this is thinking more widely about whom you think you serve. Kat Cole is the president and chief operating officer of Focus Brands, which include Cinnabon, Jamba Juice, Carvel, Auntie Anne's Pretzels. Cole began her career first as a hostess before waiting tables at a Hooters restaurant. She often tells how she started traveling internationally for Hooters corporate office by age 19, working on the chain's global expansion. While what she sells are indulgences, she takes a holistic approach to leadership. Ms. Cole, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you had to find a job as a teenager to what? Help your family get food on the table?
Really to help save money for my own needs. We had passed the phase where my mom was working three jobs and feeding us on a food budget of $10 a week, which she did for 3 years. By the time I was 15, my mom had a little bit of a better job, but not enough for college for her three girls. And so if I wanted anything, I needed to work for it. So I started working in malls and then eventually restaurants.
Kat, your Twitter handle is different now, but I know in the past it has been about being a connected, conscious capitalist. What does that mean to you?
I think it means destigmatizing and redefining capitalism as an ecosystem that has people and more stakeholders pulled to the forefront as opposed to afterthoughts, you know, not the sole purpose of the enterprise being the shareholder, but rather understanding that by caring for connected stakeholders, employees, customers, vendors, that is where capitalism is going, has been moving, and must continue to go so that the great divide of the haves and have-nots does not continue to widen.
You referred to destigmatizing capitalism. Is that part of the stigma? Is that it's made the gap between rich and poor worse in some cases?
It is the stigma, right? Is there any other stigma? When people hear capitalism, they either say, yes, I'm a capitalist and I'm all about free markets and individualism and all of those things that are related, or it's the other side, which is capitalism is only focused on markets and shareholders without consideration for downstream and social and economic implications. And so the shift from shareholder to stakeholder is needed, shareholders being a key stakeholder because they're putting up the money to make the enterprise possible in the first place. So they're critical. But if the other things aren't impacted positively, there is no business over time.
Kat Cole, President and Chief Operating Officer of Focus Brands, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
So many people are challenging the way our economy works and who it's working for. And those ideas are coming from everywhere. Francis Cox, who went to college, worked as a computer programmer, and now has a job cleaning houses, wants drastic changes, starting with policies like reparations for Black Americans. But she also wants a shift in how we think.
We have to make it a people-oriented economy versus a money-oriented economy.
Her daughter Nisa and Nisa's dad, Jason, say there needs to be a way for people to get an education, college or vocational, without going into extreme debt. Massage therapist Roland in Houston wants everyone paid a living wage, for example, by raising the minimum wage. His sister, retired engineer Rochelle, wants to see more economic empathy.
It just seems like as a society, we really do need to recognize that people are going out. They are working hard. They're getting up every day. They're going to work. They're doing what they need to do. And at the end of the day, they still can't make it. That's wrong. That's wrong. And as a society, we need to have more compassion and more support for everybody.
Compassion and support for everybody. Economic inequality in America is pretty extreme across race in particular. Kathy Cohen is a University of Chicago poli-sci professor who does a regular survey of millennials that makes sure people of color are properly sampled.
We asked the question, what would be the best way to make racial progress in the United States? Voting in state and local elections, voting in federal elections, but also organizing in communities, community service, nonviolent protests, and we also included, yes, revolution. And the answer that was most prominent among African American, Asian American, and Latinx young people was organizing in communities. That was the second most popular answer, even among young whites.
It wasn't number one, but many did pick revolution, especially many Black millennials. Cohen understands this as the belief it will take transformational, systemic change for things to get better.
I do not want to restart the economy that we had. We have to reimagine.
Darren Walker is the president of the Ford Foundation, the second largest philanthropy with a $12 billion endowment.
It was a consciousness capitalism that in no way recognized the harm that inequality does to our democracy, because hope is the oxygen of democracy. Inequality asphyxiates hope, and it makes people believe that the institutions in our democracy that are supposed to advance their interests are rigged, are designed and manipulated by we privileged Americans to benefit us at their expense. And if I'm to be true and candid with you, David, they are right. They are right.
Walker has been challenging those who win in the present economic system to consider what parts of their privilege they're prepared to surrender. And here's what I learned talking to one of the tycoons of Wall Street, Ray Dalio, founder of Bridgewater Associates, the biggest hedge fund of them all. His reading of history tells them when interest rates are low, they are, great global powers are in conflict, think U.S. and China, and the gap between rich and poor gets wide, ditto again, very bad things happen, like war.
Isn't our objective to work together peacefully and achieve greatness together in a broad way? Or do you want to be fighting with each other? And there's enough money to go around, not just to redistribute it in a way where there's not a motivation for work, but in a way that more people have an opportunity to get well educated and be working together, and that we pull together. Because I fear for us fighting with each other domestically, and I fear for us fighting with each other internationally.
Over to Felicia Wong, president of the Roosevelt Institute, a think tank.
But here's the thing, David. We've got to make sure that this isn't just talk. Some of this stuff has to get into action if we are going to build a more humane and more resilient economy coming out of this than the economy we had going into this early this year.
There is an idea called the Overton Window, named after a public policy guy in Michigan who died quite young, Joseph P. Overton. It's about the window of policy possibilities that the public, politicians, and regulators consider worthy of serious consideration, you know, versus ideas so off the deep end, why even talk about them? Here in 2020, many think the drapes on the Overton Window have opened to a wider view. We've looked at some ideas here, and we'll stay on the lookout for ways to reimagine systems that work better for more people.
This Marketplace Morning Report special is supported by McDermott Will & Emery, an international law firm advising clients on the complex issues faced when dealing with a business restructuring, insolvency proceeding, or opportunity to acquire distressed assets. More at mwe.com/restructuring.
A list of those books we mentioned and more is available online. There is a trio of special Marketplace programs under the heading The Economy, What Now? Marketplace.org, if you miss any of them on the air. This piece of it, The Economy Reimagined, was produced by Candace Manriquez-Wren, Rose Conlon, Victoria Craig, Meredith Gerritsen, Daniel Shin, and Erica Soderstrom. Alex Schroeder produced the digital elements, engineering by Brian Allison and Jay Siebold. Our theme music was composed and recorded by Daniel Ramirez and Ben Tolliday. Our executive producer, Nicole Childers, oversaw the project. Each and all worked from separate locations, most from home. With Kimberly Adams, I'm David Brancaccio. This is APM, American Public Media.